We are 10 weeks into the Gospel of Mark, and we are on verse 21. But starting today, the plan is to kick it up a notch. The plan is actually to cover from verse 21 all the way to the end of the chapter. Wow. Are you up for that? On a summer day, almost summer day. Some of you are thinking, I'll believe it when I see it. Well, you never know. And here's why. The rest of Mark 1 takes place over a 24-hour time period. It's essentially a day in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. It's Mark, the author's way of saying, listen, this is what Jesus' kingdom work was all about 6 feet off the ground. Now we have a ton of ground to cover, so let's plunge in and get to work. Mark chapter 1, let's start off in verse 21. They went to Capernaum, and when the Sabbath came, Jesus went into the synagogue and began to teach. Okay, circle four words if you're taking notes. Capernaum, Sabbath, synagogue, and teach. First off, Capernaum, or Capernaum in Hebrew, meaning the village of Nahum, think of the prophet, was located on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus grew up, as you know, a few miles to the southwest in Nazareth, but think of Capernaum as Jesus' home, or at least Jesus' home base, for his few short years in the public eye. He probably used Peter's house as kind of headquarters, a ground central for Jesus' kingdom work. Now, this story takes place on the Sabbath, which is the Jewish day for rest and worship from Friday evening to Saturday evening, because the Jews measured time from sunset to sunset. And this story takes place in the synagogue. Now, the synagogue was the axis of Jewish life. Children were educated in the synagogue all week long for school. And then the entire village or city would come together on the Sabbath, first thing on Saturday morning, for the synagogue service. Now, there were four parts to the synagogue service. There was a prayer, followed by a reading from the Torah, followed by a sermon or a teaching like what I'm doing right now, followed by a closing blessing. But basically, the synagogue was teaching focused, which is why the next phrase is Jesus began to what? Teach. A synagogue in Jesus' day did not have a full-time paid pastor or rabbi or anything like. They did have a ruler of the synagogue who's responsible for running the operations of the local kind of village synagogue, but he was unpaid. If you were lucky, on the Sabbath, a visiting rabbi or scribe or priest would be in town and he would teach, which is why Jesus is invited to teach. He's a rabbi, which is a word meaning teacher. Now, he began to teach, and this is a fascinating place. I've actually been to this synagogue. Here's a picture of what's left of it. It was massive, upwards of 5,000 square feet, which was really large for Jesus' day and age. Next slide. This right here is actually a 4th century synagogue. We know that from the white limestone, but it's right built right on top of, if you look at the picture, a black basalt foundation that is from the 1st century. It was crazy to stand right where Jesus was teaching. Now, in this synagogue, watch what happens, 22. The people were amazed at his teaching because he taught them as one who had authority, not as the teachers of the law in the NIV, or it can be translated teachers of the Torah or scribes. These were educated men who were basically scholars in the Torah or the first 5 books of the Bible, what you and I would call a seminary professor. But all the teachers of the Torah would do is quote other teachers of the Torah or other rabbis. Rabbi so-and-so, have you ever heard like a Jewish sermon? It's really interesting. Rabbi so-and-so says this, and Rabbi so-and-so says this, and it's rabbi this, and it's rabbi that. Well, what do you actually think is what you think by the end of it, right? Well, Jesus was nothing like that. He just flat out is up there teaching. That was unheard of. He taught, the text says, as one with authority. Now, that word authority in Greek is exousia. Can you say that? Exousia. It's where we get the word author. Literally, or more literally, it's out of the original stuff. And Jesus is teaching in that kind of a way. Something about this rabbi is more than a rabbi. He was telling the story of the world as the author, with authority. Now, watch what happens. 23, just then, a man in their synagogue who was possessed by an impure spirit cried out, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." The impure spirit, which is another way of saying a demon, is scared to death of Jesus. And for good reason. I mean, Jesus is encroaching on his turf. This whole, "I know who you are, the Holy One of God," kind of weird business, was a tactic used in Jesus' day. It was thought that if you said your spiritual enemy, if you kind of said his name out loud and his rank in the hierarchy of the demonic or the spiritual world, you somehow had a tactical advantage over him. But it does not work. 25, "Be quiet," said Jesus sternly, which can be translated, "Shut up, come out of him." And the impure spirit shook the man violently and came out of him with a shriek. Now this right here was unheard of. You and I read right over that. Yeah, well, of course, he's Jesus. But this was unheard of. Now, demonization was an epidemic in Jesus' day all over the ancient Mediterranean, as it is in much of the world today. We have all sorts of rabbinic writings on exorcism, and they are all elaborate, complex, kind of long-winded, really almost like magic, almost like an incantation. You would invoke the authority of Solomon, was the most popular in Jesus' day, or Isaiah the prophet, or some figure in history or in the world. You would evoke the authority, and then you would go through a ritual. You would do all sorts of crazy stuff. You would hold up feces to the victim's nose to try to drive the demon out, or you would pour water over the victim to try to wash the demon out, or in a practice called trepanning, you would actually drill a hole in the victim's skull to let the demon out, and then the victim, if he survived or she survived, would wear the bone around his or her neck as an amulet to ward off an impure spirit. I mean, this was actually common. I was just reading about one archaeological dig, dug up a cemetery, which is kind of mean. I don't know why they did that, but they dug up a cemetery, and out of 120 people in the cemetery, 6 had a hole in their head because of this. So this was not that uncommon. Now, here's what's crazy. Jesus doesn't do any of that. There's no "in the name of so-and-so, Abacurta." There's no Harry Potter going on here, right? There's just none of that. Sorry, I know, like middle schoolers, I'm bummed for you. But there's none of that. It's just shut up and get out now. And it works, which is why the people were all so amazed that they asked each other, what is this? A new teaching, and with exousia, with authority. He even gives orders to the impure spirits, and they they obey him. The people are amazed. This word amazed is used all over Mark's gospel. It's actually used twice right here in one story. I mean, at the beginning and at the end, people are flat out blown away by Jesus of Nazareth, which is why 28, news about him spread quickly over the whole region of Galilee. Capernaum is located right off the major north-south trade route running all the way through the Middle East, which means you do something in Capernaum and it's out all over the place in a flash. But let's keep reading. The story's not over. In fact, Jesus' day is just getting started. 29, as soon as they left the synagogue, probably early afternoon, they went with James and John to the house of Simon and Andrew. There's no such thing as a single family dwelling in the triangle. People lived in what was called an insula complex, which was basically 4 homes built around an open-air courtyard where you would do all your cooking and laundry and work. And the entire extended family lived in the complex. Can you imagine that? You're like, no. That could be a really good thing or a really bad thing. No comment from this guy, all right? But upwards of 50 or 60 people lived in a quote-unquote home. That's what's going on right here. Simon and Andrew and 30. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever. They immediately told Jesus about her because Jesus has exousia. Jesus has authority over the demonic. I mean, who knows over whatever else? Keep in mind that a fever in Jesus' day was a life-threatening illness. So, 31, he went to her, took her hand, and helped her up. The fever left her, and she began to wait on them, which is how it should be, right? No, I'm kidding. Don't, 110%. Don't read this as sexist at all. Okay, mom-in-law, you're healthy. Get into the kitchen, right? Don't read it that way at all. Read this as full, complete, total, holistic healing of body and soul all together. To Jesus, healing is not just about getting to maintenance mode, not just about getting quote-unquote better. No, healing is about flourishing as God created you to be. The fever left her and she began to wait on them. Now, keep reading. The day is not over. That evening, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all who were ill and demon-possessed. Keep in mind, it's the Sabbath. You can't work and you can't travel on the Sabbath, but the second the sun goes down, the end of the Jewish day, okay, the whole town is at the front door. 1,500 people on Jesus' front lawn. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Man, that's insane. That phrase, Jesus healed many, can be translated a great number were healed. Late into the night, Jesus is healing the sick, casting out demon after demon after demon. But the story is not over. Keep reading. 35. Keep in mind, there's no paragraph break in the original text. There's no subheading. You know, my Bible says Jesus prays in a solitary place. None of that's there. It's one long, drawn-out story. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. He gets up early, goes off to a solitary place. It's actually the exact same word used for the wilderness or the desert all over Mark 1. And he needs to get away from the 50 or 60 people in the house and get alone with God in prayer. Now, Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you. What are you doing out here praying? Jesus, you're blowing up right now in Capernaum. I mean, like, you are like, you're trending all over Twitter. And the New York Times is on the phone. Rolling Stone wants to do an interview. Jimmy Kimmel wants you on Late Night. What are you doing out here alone praying?" And then Jesus replied, 38, "Well, let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so that I can preach there also." I'm like, that is why I have come. So much clarity, so much focus. I mean, he basically says, no, that's not right. Like, that is why I've come, to move on. So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. Meaning, what happened over a 24-hour time period in Capernaum is now starting to happen all over Galilee, up and down the lake, in village after village, synagogue after synagogue, home after home, story after story. Now, before we finish up the chapter, notice three things from a day in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. First off, Jesus did his work in the synagogue and in the home. Or in language you may be more familiar with from around here, Jesus did his work in the gathering of God's people and in the scattering of God's people, because to Jesus, it was a both and. He was all about synagogue on Sabbath morning with all God's people in one large building, and he was all about life in a living room, so to speak, or an open-air courtyard with your mother-in-law. Either way, he was all about the both and. There's this myth right now that Jesus was anti-organized religion. And there's truth in it. I mean, for sure, Jesus did not come to found a religion. If that's how you think of Jesus, you're wrong. But at the same time, Jesus is not down on organized worship of God. He's a well-organized guy. Like, there's this idea that Jesus was basically a first century hipster, just kind of this wandering beatnik, poet, prophet, kind of artsy dude who was anti-establishment and all about rebellion and all this kind of stuff. And there's also, on top of that, kind of this idea that teaching is, if not bad, at least unnecessary. Like, really? I mean, can we just do away with that? Really, church is just about me and my buddy at the bar, and let's just enjoy life, right? The problem with that, I was reading a blog just the other day that said Jesus wasn't about information, he was about transformation. I'm like, well, he's definitely about transformation, for sure, but that's just not right. He was a rabbi. That's a word meaning teacher. He was all about teaching. He was soaked in Israel's scriptures, what you and I call the Old Testament. He was known all up and down Judea, really for two things, for his teaching and for his miracles. That's what he was known for, all over. And he was found teaching in village after village, large crowds of people. He really was all about that, which is just absolutely interesting to me. All that does, and he did that in the synagogue. Like, not all in the synagogue until he outgrew the synagogue, and then he did it outside. All that to say, we need both. We need the synagogue, meaning the weekly gathering of God's people, with teaching. Jesus was all about that, so are we. But we also need just as much, if not more so, the week-long scattering of God's people into a home, into a coffee shop, into a park on a day like today. And if you only have one or the other, you're missing out. If you're anti kind of the synagogue thing, you're missing out. If you're anti the home thing, you're missing out. If all you experience of church is this right here, oh gosh, I mean, you're seriously missing out on the kingdom of God. Jesus was all about both. Now, secondly, if you're taking notes, Jesus saw the home as a place of ministry and mission. Forgive me for the churchy language in that, but what I mean by ministry is serving people inside God's family. What I mean by mission is serving people outside the faith. And Jesus saw the home as an epicenter of both. So often we think of, maybe it's just me, but we think of the home or your apartment or your condo or your mom's basement or garage or your dorm or the Airstream in your backyard, whatever, as a retreat from ministry and mission. Man, this, my home, is my time, my place. This is where I go to unwind, to unplug, to get away from it all, to veg out, watch TV. Have you heard of Netflix? It's awesome. This is my spot, right? This is where I go. And then I go out to I'm all about kingdom stuff. Absolutely. I'm all about serving, but I do all of that out at church or at work or at Portland Rescue Mission or whatever it might be. But to Jesus, it was inverted. It was the other way around. Home was the place of serving. The door was open 24/7 to those in need. And when Jesus needed rest, he would go out to a solitary place, which you would too if there were 60 people living at your house. But he went out to when he needed rest, that's not what home was for. Home was for serving. He needed to go out. Now, this has profound implications for how you think about your family if you're a parent. When you get home from work, you have a second job that is way more important than the one you get paid for. And you moms and dads know parenting is hard work. I think so much of being a good mom or dad is it just comes down to work ethic, to be honest. Because you get home, you're dead tired, you're worn down, and your children are not, to say the least. And it's hard work to be there and to actually be there. Because we all know you can be in the living room, you can be in the house and be a million miles away. It's hard work to be fully present with your family. That means, guys, there's no ESPN Sports Center playing. That's not playing with your children, all right? There's no, you're not shopping online. When your children are there, when it's family time, you're with your family. If you're a millennial, you're not on Instagram, okay? You're with your children. Like, you're present, you're fully open, you're fully available for your family. By the time your kids go to bed, if you have at all little children, you should be dead tired. That means you're doing a fabulous job as a parent. And that's what I think has profound implications for how we think about that. I think it has profound implications for how we think about missional community. Is your home open? Are your neighbors in your home all the time? Have you learned the art of hospitality? Have you learned how to cook, or at least where to shop, right? Or where to eat out? Have you learned, is your house the de facto community center for your neighborhood? Is your house where people want to come over and hang out and eat and enjoy good food and taste of what God's rule is like? All that to say, what would it look like for you to think of your home, or apartment or condo or whatever, think of your home not as a retreat from the kingdom of God, but as the epicenter of your kingdom work? What would it look like to reimagine your living room as, man, this is ground zero for my serving, for God's calling on my life? What would it look like to think of your kitchen table as the place where the really good Jesus stuff happens through you? That's what Jesus was all about. And then last, Jesus carved out time to get alone with God. I know it's obvious, but I think it needs to be said. After a long, hard, busy, frenetic day, does Jesus sleep in the next morning? No, I would. I mean, seriously, if I was up late at night healing all of you guys, good grief. Casting demons out of all of you, my goodness. I would sleep in the next morning, make a little French press, play on my iPhone for a bit, catch up on the news, take the day off. I mean, that's how I roll, right? Not Jesus. He's up early, out of the house, off to a solitary place in prayer. That was Jesus' rhythm of renewal. What's yours? What's your rhythm of renewal? How many of you get tired? I do. I'm tired right now. I'm a few weeks away from vacation, and I'm really tired right now. I woke up this morning, and I thought, I just want to go back to bed, not teach. I'm like, oh, dang it, I'm a pastor. I'm not supposed to feel that way. I'm supposed to feel awesome all the time. Yeah, Jesus, woo, let's do it. Listen, at 5:30 this morning, I was more like, no. Like, I get tired. I get worn down. I mean, in particular for me emotionally. I mean, that for me, that bucket for me just gets empty really fast. What is your rhythm of renewal? Maybe you're like me and you're introverted and it's time alone. It's quiet. It's reading. It's a long walk to think. It's beauty. It's creation. Maybe you're extroverted and that sounds like torture. I mean, like, really? That's horrible. I want to go out and party and see the town, hang out with my friends and family, like my buddy Gerald says. More people, more fun. Like, or not. Like, whatever. But however you're wired, introverted or extroverted or somewhere in between, however you're wired, listen to me. You need time alone with God. No matter how social you are, you need to create space daily, weekly, monthly, and annually where your phone is off, your email is closed, right? Your headphones are out, and it's just you. And you're in tune, and you're awake, and you're aware, and you're after God's Spirit in prayer. Notice that Jesus does not grab his Bible and his moleskin and head off to a park bench, right? This is 1,500 years before Mr. Gutenberg. The Bible of the day was on a scroll, actually on more like 20, in the local synagogue. He did not have the luxury that you and I have of being able to actually get up with a cup of coffee and read the Bible. Now, that's not in any way down on reading the scriptures. Do it 365 days a year. All that to say, in your time with God, whether it's in the morning, and there's not a legalistic thing there, but man, there is something about the morning. Or it's at night, or on your lunch break, wherever it is, in your time when you're just time with God, that's so stupid. All of your life is time with God. But when you really get alone with God, make sure it's time set aside for reading the scriptures, but also for prayer, where you talk to God. You get stuff off your chest. This morning, there was just stuff that was on my chest. Jesus, I'm just tired this morning. I need help. And you listen to God. You listen to God's Spirit speak over you. It's a both and. All that to say, and it's not an accident that Jesus comes out of this early morning time with clarity and focus. That's what time alone with God does. I mean, you're centered by time in prayer. You get vision, you get clarity, you get trajectory, you get, okay, we're going here, we're going there. Okay, that's it. This is what matters. This is what's peripheral. Okay, here we go. So your time alone, your time in prayer, your time in the scriptures should do. All that to say, this coming week, no matter how busy you are, get alone with God. Some of you are about to make a decision. Have you spent time in prayer? Have you spent, and not just yapping at God, but actually open, quiet listening, and not just for a second or 20, but have you actually spent time in prayer, open to God's Spirit? If you're anything like me, the busier I get, the less time I spend in prayer, the less time I spend alone with God. We all know it's the exact opposite that should happen, right? The busier you get, the more you need to up your time. In fact, you can chart, if you read all four Gospels, you can chart kind of the busier Jesus was in popularity and fame and notoriety and craziness, the more Jesus would slip away to pray and get alone and go up to a mountain and get up earlier. You can chart the two side by side. That's how it should be for you and I. And as a generation addicted to technology, addicted to work, addicted to busyness, addicted to entertainment, the time is ripe for a prophetic witness in the church, for a people that will stand up and say, listen, this is what it looks like to live under the rule of God. This is what it looks like to live without an addiction to technology. This is what it looks like to live in peace. It's what it looks like to live with your mind focused and open to the Spirit of God. That's what God is calling you and I to. Now, back to the story. Let's wrap up. There's one more kind of odd story that Mark puts in right after that, almost like an illustration of the kind of stuff that was happening all over the Galilee. Let's read it. 40. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Now, leprosy, no disease was more feared in the ancient Near East than leprosy. As you know, it was a skin disease. Nodules would start to form all over your body, but in particular on your face, around your mouth and your nose and all over your forehead. They would start to ooze and ulcerate, and pus would start to leak off of your face. You would start to look far more like a monster than a human being. Then you would start to waste away. Your hands and feet would shrivel up and disfigure. Then your fingers and toes would fall off. And then after about a decade, you would die. But that actually wasn't the worst part. The worst part was that you were unclean in Jewish lingo, meaning you were a social outcast. Literally, you were not allowed to live or work in the city. By law, you had to live outside the city in a leper camp. You could not walk within 50 feet of a Jewish citizen without crying out, "Unclean! Unclean!" Can you imagine how embarrassing that would have been? You were cut off. You could not go to the temple in Jerusalem. You're cut off not only from society, but from God. You could not go to the temple in Jerusalem. If you were lucky and your synagogue ruler was lenient, you could go to the synagogue, but you had to go early before everybody and hide behind a black cloth, and then you could not step out until after the synagogue was empty. I mean, you were in absolute isolation. And this is a guy, basically the living dead, with leprosy, dying, and he's desperate. The man came to him and begged him on his knees. Get the picture? "If you're willing, you can make me clean." Now, Jesus, 41, was indignant. He reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." Now, that, you and I kind of skip right over that. Oh, that was absolutely staggering. He touched the man. A rabbi would never touch a leper. Never. For starters, they thought it was a contagious disease. That would be like sharing a needle with an AIDS victim. It was that shocking, that unheard of. And secondly, the teachers of the Torah said that if you touched anybody with leprosy, you were unclean. It was not good for a rabbi to be unclean. Like, that's a disaster. But is Jesus unclean? No. In fact, Jesus touched the man and the man became clean. Man, this says so much about God, so much about what God is like with people that are screwed up, so much about God's heart for people that are on the margin of society, for people that have been passed over by the religious leaders of the day. This says so much about God's heart for you. And there's this horrific kind of idea that I think is, I don't know, somehow like in a primal way in our subconscious as a human being that thinks, I kind of need to get my act together, then I can come to God. That's ridiculous. It's like saying, I really need to get healthy before I can go see the doctor. It's the exact same logic. And we know it's stupid. But how many of you feel that way from time to time? And there's this myth, you know, I flat out have heard people say, God cannot tolerate sin in his presence. Is that true or not true? Well, it's not true of Jesus at all. I mean, Jesus looks for people with sin and he goes after them and he takes his presence to them. The truth is that the unclean is made clean in God's presence. The leper is made healthy and whole and new in God's presence. That's what God is like. Immediately, 42, the leprosy left him and he was what? Cleansed. I mean, not just made better, full on cleansed. That, my friends, is straight up a miracle. I mean, it's not just, okay, you have a sick, you have a fever, and you're on the bed, and you're sick, and okay, now you feel better. Great, awesome, God healed you. That's huge. This is full on, your body is falling apart, you're missing fingers and toes, you look like a gothic, I mean, you look disgusting, and in one word, you're cleansed. I mean, you look like you just got out of the spa from some yuppie spot in Lake Oswego. I mean, you're just looking great. I mean, can you imagine that? That is a full-on miracle. Jesus, 43, sent him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone, but, I'm sorry, go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. There are two whole chapters in Leviticus about what to do if you're healed from leprosy. As far as we know, it had, I'm sorry, never happened except for a story or two in the Old Testament. Jesus says, listen, hey, go to the priest in Jerusalem, 90-mile walk, but that's okay, you're free, and obey Leviticus 13, obey Leviticus 14, go through the ritual, and then do it all as a testimony of God's healing work. But instead, 45, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. Because of the kind of stuff Jesus was up to, overnight, he's a household name in Israel. People from all over, up and down Judea, come to see this rabbi, this miracle worker, this teacher, this prophet, maybe even more, maybe this Messiah who has the exousia or the authority of the author of life. Now, two thoughts really fast before we wrap up. First, it's easy to read Mark 1 as a random hodgepodge of stories about exorcisms and healings and miracles, but kind of with no theme. It's kind of random. Lots of people think of the stories basically as random acts of kindness, as if the main point is that Jesus is nice. And while I'm positive that Jesus was nice, at least most of the time, I don't think that's the main point that Mark is making. Lots of other people read the stories as proof that Jesus was God. Like, Jesus healed a man. Hey, look, that's proof Jesus is God. Or Jesus healed that man. Oh, wow, that's proof Jesus is God. And while I 120% believe that Jesus is Yahweh come back to Israel, absolutely, full on, I don't think that's quite the main point either. That's actually a slippery slope, because what do you do with the rest of the scriptures? We read about Elijah and Elisha and Peter and Paul, who all did basically the exact same kind of stuff. We don't say, well, Elijah, he healed a man, that makes him God. No. Paul, he healed a man. Peter, resurrection, oh, that makes him Yahweh. No, not at all. Like, there's something else going on. I would argue that the way that you and I should read these, what sound random to you and me, stories, is as signs of the inbreaking rule of God. That's how you should read about the exorcisms and the healings and the miracles. These are signs of God's kingdom breaking over Jesus' world. New Testament scholar N.T. Wright calls them symbolic acts. Meaning not one of them is random. Not one of them is haphazard. Every single one is on purpose. This is all stuff that the Messiah was supposed to do to usher in the age to come. The scriptures are chock full of prophecy after prophecy after prophecy. This is what it's going to be like when Messiah comes. This is what it's going to be like when resurrection comes. This is what it's going to be like when the kingdom of God comes. And it was all about healing and freedom and release and renewal and the return to the garden. This is all Messiah kind of stuff. These stories are Mark's way of saying, listen, this is what God's rule looks like. This is a glimpse of the world that's coming on the horizon, healing, new life, freedom, inclusion. But it's also a glimpse of the world that's here now in Jesus and the Spirit. All that to say, if you want to know what the kingdom of God is like, what it looks like, well, it looks like freedom from the demonic. It looks like Jesus healing your mother-in-law. It looks like Jesus touching a social outcast. It looks like the miraculous. This is what God's rule, this is what it looks like when God's in charge. This is what society looks like when God's king. This is what the rule of God looks like. Now, on that note, secondly, just because you're in church doesn't mean you have your act together. Right? You're like, dude, you are living proof of that. I am. Thank you very much. Just because you're here and you're well-dressed and you have a smile on your face and coffee in your hand, hi, how are you, doesn't mean you're not a wreck on the inside. Right? Who? Just because you're here and you know the Bible and you know theology doesn't really mean that much. Who has the best theology in all of Mark 1? Yeah, the demon. I mean, that dude is a theologian. He knows. I mean, the disciples are clueless about Jesus' identity. You, the reader, know Mark, but I mean, really everybody's in the dark, but that demon is spot on. I know who you are. You are the Holy One of God. And he is screwed up to the core. Just because you're here doesn't mean you have your act together. And I find it fascinating that the first story takes place in a synagogue, the one about the demoniac. And the last story takes place in a synagogue. So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. But because of that, we don't know for sure, the man with leprosy, we think that takes place in the synagogue. This is all gnarly stuff, right? The demonic, would you agree? That's pretty gnarly. And this is happening in what you and I would call church, in the synagogue. Maybe you're here. I mean, all that to say, my guess is that if we had a way to count up all the pain and abuse and addiction and dysfunction and brokenness and betrayal and guilt and shame in this room, that it would be nauseating. And maybe you're here today and you need a sign of God's inbreaking rule. You cannot wait for death and resurrection. You need it now. Maybe it has to do with the demonic. I mean, maybe just you are under the power, the influence of a demonic being. That doesn't mean you're possessed per se, but maybe it's nightmare, night terror. Maybe it's fear. Maybe it's a panic attack. I have no idea, but maybe there is something in your life that is just off. Maybe it's from your childhood. Maybe it's from abuse. Maybe it's from stuff that you are in. I have no clue. Maybe you're here and you need freedom from the demonic. Maybe you're here and it's not that at all, but it's sickness, like you're just not well. Maybe it's life-threatening, like the woman in the story. Maybe it's not at all, but it's debilitating. You're stuck in bed, and it's keeping you from serving God. It's keeping you from serving your family. It's keeping you from flourishing. Jesus can heal you today. Jesus has authority over both the demonic and over your body. Maybe here, and it's the miraculous, you flat out need a move of God in your life. You need something that's impossible. I mean, there's just no way for your marriage to come back. There's just no way for you fill in the blank, but you need it. And you just need a sign of God's inbreaking rule. If that's you here today, all we want to do is pray over you. We don't want to embarrass you. We're not going to make you speak. We're not going to make you any of that. But we are going to ask you to stand up right now. Any of that rings true to you, and if you feel like, gosh, I just need a move of the Spirit of God in my life today, then thank you for your courage, sir, so much. We're just going to ask you to stand up. You don't have to say anything. Everybody here is for you. Don't feel embarrassed at all. Don't feel weird. Everybody here is 110% for you. I'm just going to create some space. Just stand up. If there's anything demonic that you want freedom from, I believe that Jesus is going to set you free from that. If it's healing over your body, oh, man, I'm going to pray for that. If it's the miraculous, you just need God to do something in your life, and you're just at that spot where you're a little bit desperate today, then just stand up, and we're all here, we're all for you, and we just want to pray for you. I'm just going to give one more second for anybody who wants to stand up. Well done. Holy Spirit, I just pray that right now you do your stuff over every man and every woman standing. Oh, God, we need you. There's a prophetic word spoken last hour about just this image of a Nazi concentration camp with the barbed wire being torn open and people walking out. Pray that would happen right now, God, that you would just set people free from the demonic, from disease, from a life with no hope, from anything that is not your kingdom. Holy Spirit, we just invite you. We surrender to you now. I'm done. We just want to open up space for you to do your work. Have your way, Holy Spirit.